From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's a spotlight on music and musicians on today's show, starting with a look at what happens to your brain when you're listening to a song.
Then concert pianist and Carthage College faculty member Wael Farouk talks about preparing to play all 5 Beethoven concertos in one evening.
Initially wanted to do 3, and I said, well, why not do all 5? So the more intriguing is just to find someone as crazy as I am and agreeing to do it.
And for millions of Americans of a certain age, Johnny Mathis was their romantic soundtrack. But the singer says that was never the point.
I just sang, and then somebody said, well, it always sounds romantic. I said, yeah, but I sing a lot of stuff. And they said, no, everybody thinks about you as a romantic singer. And I used to talk to my dad about it. He said, well, son, maybe that's not so bad.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Monday on the show, we featured some in-studio and, in one case, in a cave, musical performances. Yesterday was our annual all-music holiday show. And today on the show, we're going to feature some more conversations about music.
Christmas has passed, so you may not hear any more renditions of Jingle Bells and White Christmas in 2018. But music is with us year-round. And according to a recent Nielsen study, Americans are actually listening to more music than ever.
For many of us, music is a source of great joy and often a way to get through difficult situations. Professor Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist and author of This Is Your Brain on Music.
He explains to Lake Effect's Mayan Silver why music helps us so much, starting with what happens to your brain when you listen to music.
Well, that's a big question. There's all kinds of things happening when you listen to music you like, but I think one of the most interesting things is that it activates the well-known pleasure center of the brain. The same part of the brain that gives you pleasurable feelings when you're hungry and then you finally eat, when you're an alcoholic and you have a drink, when you have sex. And music activates that same region of the brain, the kind of the sex, drugs, and rock and roll area.
Have you done studies where you're looking at people's brains when what activates when they're listening to music?
We have. We haven't had them drink or have sex in the scanner, but other people have done that. But we had people come in and listen to music, and we show activation in those same pleasurable brain regions.
There's really no single language center or single music center in the brain, right?
That's right. We used to think that maybe 25 years ago. Now we realize that as far as language and music are concerned and many other things, they're distributed in vast, far-reaching networks throughout the brain. And some of the most recent evidence suggests that music and language use the same circuits, but that the neurons are functioning in different modes depending on whether it's music or language.
Wow. So what is going on in the brain when you listen to a piece of music that you like?
Well, as I said, it activates the pleasure center. That includes the nucleus accumbens and the ventral tegmental area. It releases dopamine, which is in that part of the brain responsible for feelings of reward. I don't want to go too far off the track, but dopamine's an interesting chemical because it does different things at different parts of the brain. In the frontal lobes, it helps you to pay attention and stay focused. In the limbic system, it delivers pleasure. The other things that might happen when you hear music that you like is that it could increase your mood, release serotonin, or allow the serotonin that's already in your brain to stay around longer, which elevates your mood.
Why does certain music elevate your mood in certain pieces when certain people listen to it and other people it doesn't have that effect?
This is the million-dollar question, and we don't know. There's no one piece of music that everybody likes. There's no one piece of music that everybody hates. It's so subjective. And so when we're talking about pleasurable music, what we're talking about is music that the individual finds pleasurable, not that the experimenter or the professor says ought to be pleasurable. That's a whole different thing.
And so what are some of those things that help us develop tastes in music and things that we like?
Well, you know, I'm sorry not to have the answer to that. It's hard to say. There are individual differences in aesthetic taste that span all domains of taste. So some people like spicy food. Some people have a sweet tooth. Why? Why is that? Well, it has a partly genetic basis, partly a basis in your experiences and things you've been exposed to growing up, the kinds of things that were reinforced. And then there's a random factor. We just don't know. The interesting thing is that one dimension we've mapped is openness to new experiences. This probably is something that makes intuitive sense. Some people are more open to new experience and others are less. And that shows up in their preferences for music and their preferences for food. You probably know somebody that you know who you go out to a meal with, and they always want to eat at the same restaurant. And once they get there, they want to order the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know other people who are always checking Zagat. They want to find the newest restaurant, the newest thing. And, you know, that's a personality trait that has a genetic basis, a neural basis, an experiential basis. All those factors contribute to it. And they show up in musical taste, too.
So is that something that you can develop? Like, with time, you can start to like certain types of things that you're exposed to more often?
You know, to a certain extent, our musical taste is greatly influenced by what we hear between the ages of 12 and 20. Part of it has to do with brain development and the pubertal growth hormones and just the way the brain is maturing. The stuff that happens through those years seems vitally important. And it's not just music that we have a better memory for from that period. We remember a lot of things better from that period of our lives. That partly influences our openness to different kinds of music. If we heard lots of different kinds of music in that age range, we're more likely to seek multiple kinds of music later. It's something you can make an effort to do. You can make an effort to go out and listen to new concerts, new symphonies, new expose yourself to new paintings, new dance, all art forms. Whether it'll take or not, depends on your brain and your genetics.
Well, you talked about in your book, for example, with Latin rhythms. There's all types of different sounds, different rhythms and textures. And you said that you've worked with people that may not initially appreciate it, but then once you teach them the rhythms, they start to appreciate it.
I think that education is a part of it. So I remember when I was a kid, to my parents, the Beatles were indistinguishable from Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. It all sounded the same to them. But that was 50 years ago. Now, they've been exposed to it. They've learned a little bit about it through me and my sister and other young friends they have. And now that knowledge helps them to appreciate it. I didn't really understand Latin rhythms until I started playing in an Afro-Cuban band. And then I grew a taste for it. And I know a number of other people who did too, through education and exposure.
And so the people that are seeking out new songs and listening experiences, is something happening to their brain that doesn't happen to the people that aren't seeking out those new musics?
Everything you do changes your brain. That's what experience is. This conversation we're having is changing both of our brains. If you eat a pickle after we get off the phone, that's going to change your brain. Every sensory, perceptual experience, every idea, thought you have changes the brain in some chemical way. That's what experience is. That's what learning is. So at some level, people who seek new music are changing their brains, but people who don't are changing their brains. What may happen as you, I think what the answer that you were after.
Which... No, that's a perfect answer. I love that answer.
I think what people mean to get at when they ask a question like that is, is there a benefit? Or, what's the interesting way in which my brain is changing? And when you experience something new, your brain forms a pathway that represents that experience. And then the more times you repeat that experience, the more learned, the deeper the pathway becomes. And it allows you to access it. Now, that doesn't mean you'll like it, but familiarity is part of aesthetic appreciation of anything. I was thinking about this just the other day. I had a foot massage, and the person pressed on a part of my foot that if I had been tied up by gangsters and they were, you know, threatening me and they caused that pain in my body, I would give them the combination to the safe or whatever, right? But I would reveal state secrets if only I had them, if only someone had trusted me with them. But here, in the context of a massage, I know that there's a greater benefit, and so I don't experience it as pain. So the complicated thing here is listening to music that's unfamiliar to you, the way you react to it depends on your mental attitude. Am I improving myself? Am I expanding my musical horizons? Do I like the person who's exposed this to me and trust them? Or am I stuck in an elevator between floors and this new music is bombarding me and I can't turn it off?
So it's obviously the context in which they're consuming the music, but also their personality. I mean, there's multiple factors that go into it then, right?
Yes.
When you have developed those tunnels and those pathways to particular styles of music and you get really connected to it, if you're appreciating it, what is happening to your brain?
Well, at that point, when the music becomes familiar, it makes you feel good. It makes you feel comforted. It allows you to anticipate some of the pleasures that are coming up next in the song that you've heard before. The other thing that happens as we hear a piece more and more as we learn it, we know what to expect, and that can be comforting.
Are there studies that are showing that listening to music can be, I mean, obviously there's musical therapy, but can music be a medicine in almost some regards?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of work on this lately. And in fact, the National Institutes of Health has just issued a call for research proposals where they want to fund a few million dollars worth of studies looking at music and health.
And what are some of the things that have been found and are you're maybe hoping that can be looked at?
Well, what's driving this, Francis Collins, by the way, the director of the NIH, is a musician. And during his watch at the NIH, a number of studies have been done. But this is the first time there's been an actual subfield of music and health, music and medicine, created within the National Institutes of Health. Some of the findings we've seen along the way are that people in a preoperative theater about to undergo surgery, normally in that environment you give them Valium or one of the benzodiazepines to calm them down. And in one study, people were either given that or they were given relaxing music to listen to. And the ones who were given music to listen to did a much better job of getting through the surgery. Their blood pressure stayed more stable, they were more relaxed, they had better outcomes, and all this without the use of drugs. I mean, benzodiazepines are addictive, they have side effects. I mean, I suppose you could say that music is addictive and have side effects, but it's not the same thing at all.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned relaxing music. Are certain styles of music doing different things in our brain when we listen to them, serving different functions, or is it all sort of hitting the same kind of familiarity pleasure system in our brain?
Well, yeah, there's a lot more to it than that. So some music relaxes us. That releases perhaps prolactin, the soothing hormone that's released between mothers and infants during nursing. Relaxing, comforting music, sad music probably involves prolactin. Listening to music that's energizing, like to help you get through your workout, like we've seen athletes use in practices, that music might release adrenaline to help pump you up. It seems as though different styles of music, different emotional styles of music, elicit different neurochemical reactions in the brain and evoke different neural circuits that contribute to the feelings that we get. Another one is knowledge. Some music with lyrics is really about imparting information. Look at a number of songs we had as kids, like the ABCs. You learn the alphabet to a melody, right? Or you learn the body parts through melody. You put your right foot in, you put your right foot out, you shake it all about, you do the hokey pokey, and that, Mayan, is what it's all about.
your brain is producing different responses to different types of music. And we know that, right?
As yes.
Like when we listen to it. So then we seek it out, right?
Right.
And so...
And we do. There are a number of studies that show that people tend to use music kind of like a drug. They know that there's certain music they want to reach for because of the way it'll make them feel. So there's a, you would listen to a different kind of music trying to get out of bed in the morning than you would trying to fall asleep at night. There's a certain set of songs that you might gravitate towards after you've had a fight with a loved one and you're trying to recover your sanity. And there's music that we use to help us clean the house. We sort of use music the way we use drugs to influence mood.
Where are the new frontiers in terms of figuring out how music can be used instead of drugs, instead of alcohol, instead of various things to affect mood? And I mean, are there frontiers on that?
Yeah, I think that's what music therapists are working towards. The interesting part of all this is that many of us self-medicate, and we do a pretty good job of it. We have very strong, the average person, even a non-musician, non-music therapist, has very strong intuitions about what kinds of music are going to make them feel certain ways. And we reach for them, we create playlists, we go into Spotify or one of the streaming services and say, I want music that sounds like that, and we hope that that's what'll be delivered. But even if you have a favorite song of all time, it doesn't mean you want to hear it all the time. There, you want to hear it when it's, you know, consonant with certain moods that you're trying to achieve, and that's not always the way you feel throughout the day.
What does it say about people who don't use music as a form of mood therapy or mood medication?
Well, I mean, everybody has their own way of coping with the ups and downs of life, right? Music isn't for everybody. We've got genetic diversity. It's estimated that 10% of the people in the world just don't like music, and it doesn't move them at all. And, you know, that sort of falls out of Darwinian theory. You've got genetic diversity to prevent a lack of diversity in the genome from allowing a single virus to wipe out the whole human race. So there's all this random mutation trying to stay ahead of viruses and bacteria. Some of it means that you've got people who don't like chocolate. You've got other people who don't like sex. You've got people who don't like music. That's just the way it is.
And on the flip side, is there like a 10% or a 5% or something of people that are like have levels of obsession with music that are more than the average?
Well, you're talking to one of them.
I guess you're talking to one of them, too. Well, Daniel Levitin, thank you so much for speaking about this.
Thank you. Nice to speak with you.
Daniel Levitin is a neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal. He's also the author of the 2008 book, This Is Your Brain on Music, and he's the editor of a book due out this spring called Foundations of Music Psychology. He spoke with Mayon Silver.
A quick break now, and then we'll listen back to a conversation with a Carthage College faculty member who performed all 5 Beethoven piano concertos in one evening. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Back in April, Carthage College faculty member and concert pianist Wael Farouk performed a concert at the Kenosha School called Beethoven, 5 Piano Concertos, 1 Pianist.
It's an almost superhuman feat. Each concerto is difficult enough on its own. So to find out why Farouk decided to schedule all 5 in one evening, audio engineer Jason Reavy and I took a drive to Kenosha.
Beethoven was one of the most revolutionary characters, personalities, composers, artists really ever lived. And not only that, he himself changed a lot between numbers 1 through 5, but also the piano changed a lot. And it's a great a great map, really, to see from starting. You know, the first concerto is the second concerto. So the second concerto in B flat was written first around 1798 or so. And to see his use of the keyboard and even the range of the keyboard, and then you compare that to number five, just the opening of number five, it's really a new age. And there were maybe 11 or 12 years in between, so considerably, not a really long period of time, but he adapted, what he changed, what he implemented, what he invented musically and pianistically is quite amazing. So of course, coming up with new means, with new ways of expression, new technical patterns, new effects, not only for piano, of course, for the orchestra. And it's astonishing in many ways. And of course, what he had to say still on the piano continued through the sonatas, because, you know, the last concerto is Opus 73, but he wrote sonatas all the way up to Opus 111, and then the Diabelli Variations 120, and Bagatelle's 126. So he still went on beyond those pieces.
Pushing the piano and pushing what it could do. Mm-hmm. In 1798... that was still forte piano, is that correct?
Right. He didn't really care very much for the Viennese piano, as Mozart did, for instance, or even Schubert. He was more attracted to the Broadwood English pianos. And that's part of the reason he adored Clementi and loved Clementi. And actually, surveying his musical library after he passed, there were very, very few works of his own piano music. There were only the score of Don Giovanni from Mozart, no piano works, and almost the entire works of Clementi for piano. And, of course, Beethoven was always writing to piano manufacturers saying, I need more volume, I need more keyboard, I need more, you know, this is not projecting enough. So he was, as all great composers and then beyond, he was always ahead of his time, ahead of his instrument.
Is it fair to say that Beethoven really began the modern piano, what we consider the modern piano?
Absolutely fair to say that. I believe Clementi really planted those seeds in many ways. And if you compare Clementi's writing, especially the earlier ones, or what he did was the sonata form. But in terms of fame or well-known establishment, if you compare how many of Clementi's music played versus how many of Beethoven's music, of course, you know, sadly, it's not fair comparison. But definitely, Beethoven set the stage on many, many things, and he established different level of pianistic splendor, really, or virtuosity. And Czerny, of course, picked this up, and he passed it on to Franz Liszt and the rest of the Romantics.
Could you give me a musical example of, say, something from that first concerto compared to something in the fifth concerto, and how it would have changed, you know? What shifted both musically and in terms of what the demand on the piano was?
I can perhaps compare the opening of both, and maybe one or two things later on. So this is the opening of the C major concerto, or the published number one.
Classical.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. You hear that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You can say it's still in the time of Mozart. It's still in the affects and aesthetics of Mozart. And then now number five.
can really, in that one, see, because I'm sitting next to you as you do this, and you're using so much more of the keyboard.
Right, and the pedal, and the nuances, especially in the slow movements, as incredible those outer movements are, really, to me, the slower movements are the significant ones. What he did with them was phrasing, was accompaniment, was usage of the pedal. He've gotten more adventurous and more curious and more revolutionary with the pedal, the more he could not hear. It's a very interesting connection. And you see more of that in the sonatas and, of course, in the on the concertos as well.
Can you give me a little sample of one of the slow movements?
Sure, sure. Maybe we can use both movements again of the first and the last concerto.
So stunningly beautiful. Again, the difference in those dozen years from what he was doing in that first one, where it was so much more classical, still very beautiful, but it's almost like that is his voice.
Yeah,
when you get to that one.
Sure, sure. He's gotten more and more introverted in many ways, and he's, as you will know, around 1802, 1803, he actually contemplated suicide, and we have this heartbreaking note nicknamed the Heiligenstatue, where he wrote outside Vienna a letter to his brother, really saying there's nothing left for him in the world now. His deafness is complete, and his loneliness is complete, and his isolation, and how can he keep going except his faith in God and his faith in his art and his faith that he still need to tell people and share with his fellow humans. He always refer to people like that, what he has to say more about his art and what he feels still necessary. And that's what kept him going, even past the Ninth Symphony, past the late Beethoven sonatas, and we still have those amazing string quartets. He didn't really stop. It's beyond belief.
Do you think that that very humanness of him, the fact that he suffered so much, that he was in agony in a lot of ways. Do you think that's why we still relate to him, that he still has something to say to us?
Absolutely. And I think, so I always request from all of my students to really know more about the composer. these people are long dead in many ways. And what you see on the page, that black and white ink really is nothing. It's not the piece, it's not the music, it's not the composer in any fragments. Like Franz Liszt said, it's the duty of a performer to pick up the piece from the ground and breathe life into it every time they perform it. But Beethoven is definitely one of the greatest teachers as well. He can teach us so much about struggle, about triumph, about human faith and human will. And I guess that's in many ways what sums up his greatness. Of course, he was a great technician, a great composer. It's not a matter of sheer luck or accident that he have all those masterpieces after masterpieces. But I believe struggle and triumph, that's the one thing that characterizes Beethoven's music more than anything. And sometimes also he shows us, or he teaches us, really one of the first people to do that, that music is not just about beauty. It's about, yes, pain, it's about truth, and it's about picking up, you know, the pieces, and no matter the hardship or the obstacles seems to be, there is still hope and faith, and what you can do is beyond expectations.
There's something about, it's not that music didn't express those things before Beethoven. Mm-hmm. I mean, you certainly listen to some of Mozart's things,
sure,
and it will make you cry,
right,
absolutely, yeah, or laugh, or yeah, or whatever. But there was something about what he was doing, and as you said earlier, he, in the process of doing that, changed mm-hmm. Western music forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say Western culture too, not just the music, yes. He was very personal in many ways, and of course he learned a great deal from Mozart, even more perhaps from Haydn, and of course from Clementi, and he loved Bach, and he played Bach. That was one of the other scores in his library, the double-tempered clavier, of course. And but he knew what he was, and he believed in art, and he was the one of the first people to refer to his work as my art. He refused to enter from the back door, even like Haydn or Mozart. He did not see himself a servant. He saw himself far more worthy of respect and fame even than royalty. He was incredibly witty as well, and a great sense of humor. And when people would introduce him to some of the nobility, and so and so would say, you know, prince, etc., landowner or whatever, and he will say Ludwig van Beethoven, brain owner or or a talent or something like that. So he really believed in himself and in his art, and, you know, that's another great lesson right there.
Do you have a favorite movement or a piece within the five, or does that change depending on your mood?
No. Really, each one says something different, something special. However, I feel the slow movement of the fourth concerto that we were just talking about has more of a spiritual message in it, and that's just the simplicity really reflects the completeness of his loneliness in many ways and his isolation. I mean, it's nothing extravagant. It's the only movement, it's the only slow movement in a minor key. And it's the shortest slow movement, just 2.5 pages. It's, you know, nothing really.
Can you leave us with a little bit of,
sure,
of that movement?
Sure.
But
sure,
before you do, I want to say, Dr. Wael Farouk, it has been such an honor.
Yeah.
Thank you for playing for us, and best of luck with the concerts.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Professor Wael Farouk speaking in April ahead of a concert called Beethoven, 5 Piano Concertos, 1 Pianist at Carthage College in Kenosha. He later performed the same concert at the College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. The new Philharmonic Orchestra is conducted by Kirk Musbrat, and there's more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then listen back to a conversation with the legendary singer Johnny Mathis before a concert last spring in Milwaukee. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm...
And chances are you might be familiar with both this song and the person who made it famous. Johnny Mathis emerged from a humble upbringing in San Francisco to record his first song in 1955, and he hasn't left the public stage since. Mathis, along with names like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett, have provided the romantic soundtrack to life around the world for generations.
Billboard magazine lists him as the number 6 selling album artist of all time, and Mathis continues to record new music and perform for audiences, including the crowd that gathered at the Riverside Theater for a show in May. We had the great pleasure of speaking with Johnny Mathis from his home ahead of that show. Johnny Mathis, it is an honor to speak with you.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Well, so I wanted to start in a strange place because I have known your music for a long time, but I don't think I knew until I started preparing for this interview that before you were a famous singer, you were a champion high jumper. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, kids like in school do a lot of crazy stuff, and I did, of course. I got involved in politics. I was the president of student body, but I was a high jumper and a hurdler on the track team, and my big claim to fame was that I had an outside chance of making the Olympics as a high jumper. But during that, the week that I was to try to qualify for the Olympics, I got a chance to make my first recording in New York. So instead of going to the trial for the Olympics, I went to the trial for my career, and fortunately, everything worked out.
Well, right. These were both fields that there are no guarantees. Did music seem like the more secure option for you?
Oh, my goodness. My dad was right there with me all the time and says, well, son, we'll give it a shot. We'll see what happens. Anyway, good things happened, and that's that.
Well, good things really did happen. You mentioned your dad, and I was also reading that the first piano your family owned, that your dad actually had to disassemble it and then reassemble it to get it in the front door?
Our apartment that we lived in, I lived in it with my 6 brothers and sisters, and there were always a couple of relatives who were migrating from the South to San Francisco who were staying with us. And let's see, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms and about 12 people. And my dad showed up at the house one day with a bunch of wood or sticks or something and put it together, and it became a piano. And we all heard my dad play the piano for the first time. We had no idea. But when he was a kid, he was a singer and played the piano. So that was the beginning of my career. My dad was my best pal, always. I have a lot of wonderful memories of my dad and how we started out and what he used to tell me. Come on, son, let's try this. Let's go over here and sing for this. Maybe somebody will hear you. Fortunately, somebody heard me.
You signed your first recording contract with Columbia in, I think it was 1955. Do you have any recollection of the expectations that the label had from you then?
Well, I was signed to Columbia Records by the head of jazz. His name was George Avakian, a dear, dear man who just recently passed away. He was almost 100 years old.
Wow.
But he was in the head of jazz, and he thought that perhaps he heard me sing in a jazz club in San Francisco when I was 17 or 18 years old, and said he'd come back. And sure enough, he was true to his word. He came back the next year, heard me sing at the age of 19, took me to New York, where I made my first recording, which jazz-orientated with a lot of very famous jazz musicians, John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet, Gil Evans, Manny Album, all sorts of wonderful jazzers. And I did my best, you know, to keep up with them, but it wasn't until I started working with Mitch Miller that I really found my niche, and that was singing popular songs of the day.
at what point did you maybe figure out, you know, did you start to have an inkling of what songs might be a hit?
Never. The first single recordings that I made were It's Not For Me To Say, When Sunny Gets Blue, a song called Warm and Tender by a new songwriter, Burt Bacharach. Nobody had ever heard of him. And one other one called Wonderful, Wonderful.
Sometimes we walk hand in hand by the sea, and we breathe in the cool, salty air. You turn to me with a kiss in your eyes, and my heart feels a thrill beyond compare.
I went into the studio and recorded those four songs and never heard them again until about, 6 or 8 months later. I was wandering around New York all by myself and I had to take a taxi somewhere. And lo and behold, as I was riding in the taxi, my song came on the radio, first time I'd ever heard it. And I almost wrecked the taxi, telling him to stop and listen to my song. And that was the first time I had gotten any inkling about what kind of feeling it was to have a successful career, yeah.
Suddenly you had gone from just somebody who was trying to make it as a recording artist to somebody that everyone would know.
Well, I am completely overwhelmed by the success that I've had over the years. But fortunately, I wasn't blindsided by it. I had started to take voice lessons when I was about 13 years old from a woman who gave me voice lessons free of charge. She was quite good at what she did. And fortunately, I learned enough about voice production to not injure my vocal cords, which is a big deal. And over the years, her kindness to me, because she taught me free of charge, has paid off. I've had minor little occurrences once in a while when I've sung a little bit too much. But other than and that, all of her tutoring and all of her knowledge about vocal production really was the basis of my career.
And along those lines, can you talk about what you do to get your voice ready for a concert today?
I don't talk. Yeah, the only thing you can do really is to save your voice. Don't talk. Well, you know, say yes. No, that's about it. And make sure you keep yourself 110% ready to sing. It requires a lot of maintenance, good physical habits. You want to keep yourself strong because you're supporting your vocal qualities from your diaphragm. And it's nice to have a nice, firm belly, which is something that stuck in my mind from the time I was a little kid. And I've been going to the gym now. This is about my 60th or 70th year.
Wow.
Of exercise routines. I exercise about 5 days a week all the time, yeah.
Probably not high jumping, though.
Well, no. I had two hip replacements over the years. But I did go out one day on the golf course with one of my singing buddies, and I said, "What's this all about?" And, of course, I certainly found out about it, and now my big passion, other than singing, is golf.
Now, maybe this is a strange question, but maybe not. As I was getting ready for this interview, I was remembering a scene from a movie called Diner back in the early 1980s. The movie was actually set in 1959, and in the scene there are two characters debating who the best singer was to make out to, Sinatra or Mathis.
You know the thing about Sinatra? He's good, but he's too thin. I don't like that.
Yeah, but you can't compare them. Sinatra is the Lord, all right? He's big in movies, he's big in nightclubs, he's big...
Skip that. Let me ask you another question. Start. When you want to make out, who do you make out to? Sinatra or Mathis?
That's a stupid question.
One question. Answer that.
It's irrelevant. I won't answer it.
What about you, Shirley? I'm married. We don't make out.
Do you think at all about the fact that there are generations of people who think of you as the soundtrack to their teenage dating life?
I never did. I just sang. And then somebody said, well, it always sounds romantic, what you sing. I said, yeah, but I sing a lot of stuff. I sing the Cold Deirdre. I sing Ailey Ailey, you know. I sing jazzy stuff. And they said, no, no, no. Everybody thinks about you as a romantic singer. And I said, well, I used to talk to my dad about it. He said, well, son, maybe that's not so bad. And I guess he was right.
Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field? You know, the recording industry is not always so nice to its talents. Is there a secret to being a nice guy in a field that is not always so nice?
I think it has a lot to do with your beginnings in whatever business or whatever social situation you get yourself involved with. But you must remember, I've had a lot of help along the way. I've had a lot of people who have counseled me about what would be the best way to go about my career, a personality which you must keep a low profile about, because there's so many challenges from day to day to day in a situation like I'm involved in. And all of it is just a very natural occurrence of what happens when you're raised by someone like my dad and my mom. And I have a very quiet way about doing whatever I do, but I have so much help. There's so many elements involved in just getting one person like myself into a career as I've had. And I've had so many extraordinarily wise people to help me along the way, and I can't think of anything other than that which has kept me very grounded.
As you say, you grew up in San Francisco. Even in the 1950s, I gather, San Francisco was a fairly progressive place, especially when it came to, say, racial attitudes. Can you talk about how things were different as you left home?
The thing about growing up in San Francisco was that at a very early age, I was influenced by, for instance, in school, I became president of the student body. I took classes in opera from the vocal teachers at San Francisco State College. I went to the opera in San Francisco. They had a wonderful opera company. I also frequented all the jazz clubs that my brothers and sisters took me to, because there were so many extraordinary clubs where all the people from all over the world came. And then there were Broadway shows that came through San Francisco. There were nightclubs that a young person, even when I was not of an age to go into a nightclub, when people would say, oh, that's okay, you know, he's grounded, he can stay here, he doesn't have to drink, he can listen to the performers and what have you. And all of that added up to the fact that at a very early age, I was influenced and I heard some of the greatest singers, musicians in the world come through San Francisco. And I felt comfortable learning from all of the occasions that I had. And from the time I was about 12 or 13 years old, I met some of these people. And they remembered me when I started to sing. People like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstein, Louis Armstrong, they all came through San Francisco lots of times. And my dad took me to see them. And occasionally I'd get to say hello to them, and my dad, of course, would say, my son's a singer, you know. And they always remembered that. I remember so many of the, especially Billy Eckstein. He said, oh, John, your dad drives me crazy talking about my son sings too. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me to spend my youth in San Francisco. It was immeasurable, absolutely.
There must have been some challenges for you as you were performing before the country changed the way it has.
Yeah, from the time I was 18 and started to travel, went to New York, and of course, after I made my initial recordings, the record company wanted me to go out and find jobs so that I could sing and let the people hear me. And some of these occasions took me to the south of the country, and, you know, there were all sorts of unhappy situations where I got into merely because of my color, not because of my singing. But it was embarrassing from a worldly person like me coming from San Francisco to go to places where you were denied simply because of the color of your skin. And I was a young kid. This is ridiculous, but of course, that's all a part of the world. I learned how to handle it. I learned mostly to go to where I was going to be safe, because there were instances when it became dangerous. People threatened me in the South. They wrote me terrible letters, don't come back here anymore. And I had no idea why they were doing that. But all I knew is that, that wasn't much fun, so I won't go there anymore. And that's what happens. But yeah, on the whole, because I had success at an early time, I could choose and pick the places where I wanted to go. And at a very early age, I went to Europe. And it was an eye-opener. I had a lot of success in Great Britain with my recordings. And over the years, I've gone back and back and back and had a lot of success with Christmas music over there.
Well, Johnny Mathis, it has been really rewarding to get to chat with you. I'm so thrilled that we had a chance to talk.
Oh, bless your heart. Thank you so much.
Johnny Mathis recorded his first single back in 1955, his first album in 1956, and 78 more albums since then. Back in April, his 1982 album I Love My Lady was released for the first time on vinyl for Record Store Day. Mathis performed at the Riverside Theater in May, and we spoke with him leading up to that show.
Life is a song worth singing.
We hope you enjoyed today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.